And now, Move the Sticks with Daniel Jeremiah and Bucky Brooks.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Move the Sticks, presented by Zaxby's. DJ Bucky back with you. Buck, how you doing, man?
Man, I'm good. I am good, DJ. Like, it's funny. Like, we're in that I won't say that weird time, but an interesting time, because for us, we're in the run to the playoffs. So we're paying attention to the NFL teams, but it's really time to ramp up our college study and look at these guys. And so because guys have been going, and even though some of these abbreviated seasons have been cut short and are coming to a close, like, we're trying to catch up on the players and the prospects and kind of know who's in and who's out and what to think about all of it.
Yeah, it's a weird year, man, all the way around. But yeah, with the draft prep, it is a little bit tricky right now. You know, I get names. The way I kind of go, I'll take you behind the scene here of kind of how I go about my process, is I'll talk to teams around the league. The first thing I've got to do is I got to produce a top 50 list, which is the junior declare
first
day, which
is tough. Yeah, the first one is tough.
Tough, right? So that's usually like 15th, 16th January, somewhere around there every year. So, and I eventually, like, if you look ahead to the calendar, once we get to the combine, I have to have done every player. I like to have done every single player that's at the combine. I'm fortunate enough to do that the last couple of years. So that's 350 players or whatever it is. So that's kind of where I need to get. I have these markers. I need to get to there by the combine. So when I have the top 50 list, I usually try and get to watch about 100 to 120 guys to produce my initial top 50 list. And the way I come about those names is I'll call around the buddies around the league and I'll go by position. Okay, let's go over the quarterbacks you think are top 50 caliber players. And mm-hmm. you get like six guys. Okay, let's go over the running backs you think are top 50 caliber players. Go through every position like that. And usually when you talk to enough people, you'll end up with 100 to 120 names that they think are potential top 50 picks. So that's how I sit down and watch them. So I'm working through. I've done the offensive linemen that I've, you know, I feel good about that. So I've got those guys done. So now I'm working on corners. So that's a position I'm going through. So I call these teams. So I've got my list. I put all the names in my notebook, list them all out. And so then I'm just going to go one by one. And then I start off with a couple Central Florida corners. Central Florida's got two corners that could be top 50 picks. So I pop on Central Florida. The first I see the one guy, he's lined up in the nickel. He's got dreads. Okay, I know who he is, so I can keep an eye on him. And I'm, you know, play two, play three. I can't find the other guy. Where the heck's the other guy? Can't find him. Like, okay, maybe he missed this game. Let me click on another game real quick. Click on another game. See my guy with my dreads in the slot. He's still there. Don't know where. Can't find the other guy. So I'm like, Google injury. Because normally when we're doing this, right, you don't see a guy. You type in his name, injury. Nothing. No injuries. What the heck? Where is this guy? Opted out. So he didn't play this year. So I'm gonna instead of being efficient and watching three Central Florida games and knocking those two corners out, I'm going to watch three games this year for one corner. And I got to go back and watch three games last year for the other corner. Like, it's going to make the process just so just janky, for lack of a better word.
So it's interesting because I've had this conversation with people in the league and outside the league about how are you going to treat the opt-out guys in terms of the grade and the evaluation, especially when you have maybe two guys that one played, one didn't. How are you going to do it, especially if they're similarly talented?
Oh, the advantage is going to go to the guy you just saw, if it's close.
Yeah.
Like, you haven't seen the guy playing here. You're not going to rate him over somebody if it's close.
It's really hard for me. So, for instance, the guy who joined the show, like Caleb Farley. So we've seen him play a year ago. And how do you assess that as you're projecting that out versus a Sean Wade who – decided to come back and play. And I'm not saying that they're similarly graded.
Caleb Farley's the winner in that contest. Yeah. So I'll go ahead and spoil that one.
I know, but I'm just saying, like, if they were similarly graded or whatever, like, that's the thing. But I do believe, like, this year is going to be one of the more interesting years when it comes to the draft, because there is a lot of uncertainty in terms of games played, where people are in their development, the guys that you saw versus the guys that you haven't seen, how much are you willing to bank on upside and projection versus, hey, I've seen him this year. I know exactly what he is. And even though you see him this year, how much was he impacted by the things, the stop, start, practice schedules, the whatever issues they may have suffered from internally? It's just a lot, man. It's just so much uncertainty this year more than other years. I wonder, from a decision maker standpoint, we always talk about, hey, you can win a lot of games hitting doubles. If this is the year that you're like, yeah, I'm going to be a little more conservative when it comes to my picks, to just make sure I get good guys that are just come in, they're going to contribute, and I may not worry about finding the superstar unless I'm in the top five.
Well, here's the other thing. So one of the cool advantages about being out here in Southern California is that between around where you live and down in Orange County and in San Diego, all these training facilities, right? So it's just a huge influx of players. And some of these guys that opt out have already been at some of these facilities. But because of the pandemic and California being way more restrictive and talking around to folks, it sounds like these guys aren't coming to California this year. They're going to go to Pensacola. They're going to be in Dallas. They're going to be other places just because of the limitations that they have out here, which means hopefully and hopefully I can figure out a way to make this work. But like I need to go to Pensacola. Mm-hmm. I need to go to Dallas and spend a couple of days there because I want to show up at the combine not having put eyeballs on some of these kids in over a year. And not getting a chance to see them, you know, hopefully we have the Senior Bowl. Hopefully that looks like that's going to happen. So that'll be a good opportunity to see those kids. But man, there's a whole bunch of other guys that you would normally see at the East-West game or you would see in live games that we just haven't got a chance to see this year.
Yeah, it's
want to go to Pensacola, Buck? What do you think? Road trip?
Yeah, Pensacola and Dallas. Arizona would probably kick up a little bit. I would think that at some of the places there that
– Yeah, that's a good one. You have XOs there, I think, in Arizona.
Yeah, right? So you may be able to see it because, yeah, but DJ, this is going to be, I would say, even a bigger challenge than last year when it comes to drafting. I think scouts this year will be challenged in a way that they never have because the whole virtual scouting deal, not being able to do school calls, not being able to really kind of be around them. And, yeah, we can have these Zoom calls with liaisons and administrators and coaches and those things, but there's nothing like being there face to face to not only have those in-person conversations, but to be able to observe and watch and to talk to others around the program. You're missing that. And so when you're trying to put together that profile, the profile is going to be incomplete in a bunch of different areas.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting year, man. Maybe something we can talk to our buddy, Coach Brian Billick, who's going to join the show here in just a little bit. He is the Super Bowl winning head coach. I had a chance to work with him with the Baltimore Ravens. He's been at the NFL Network for quite some time and is actually going to be part of a brand new podcast that's launching on NFL Media, which is the Total Access podcast with our other buddy, Michael Robinson. So it's going to be those two guys joining forces there for the new NFL Total Access podcast. So we're going to talk to Coach Billick here in just a minute. But before we do get to Coach Billick, I know, Buck, we were talking about this off air. I want to touch on this a little bit. With it being a weird year, we've heard John Schneider talk about the fact that factored into his trade of draft picks for Jamal Adams, who has had a really good year for them when he's been on the field and really their best pass rusher. He's been outstanding in that role. But you've got that trade. You've got the Hopkins trade, the Diggs trade. We've seen a lot of these veteran moves that those players that have moved on have really played well and made a big difference for their team. And then why don't you hit on that side of it? Then I'll hit on some of the other side, what the other teams were thinking with those moves.
Yeah, DJ, I think it's really interesting. And we've talked about it. We've talked about it in the context of where your quarterback is and where your team is. Is your team on the cusp of being able to be a legitimate contender? And only the decision-making can really assess that by saying, man, where is the hole? Where is the one piece that we need, not necessarily to get over the top, but the one thing that we know we need to shore up to get there? And so when you think about Stephon Diggs, and I think the Stephon Diggs trade is going to go down as a win-win, because I think for Buffalo, it has absolutely helped accelerate the development of Josh Allen. He has a legitimate number one receiver, and Stephon Diggs has been good. So the number one pick that you surrendered as the Buffalo Bills, you feel good about that because Stephon Diggs has given you exactly what you wanted, a high-end player that can come in and ball out. DeAndre Hopkins, which was a steal because you only had to give up a two to get, he has been a solid player. He has helped Kyler Murray. That offense has kind of run through him, and he's been good. Jamal Adams gave the Seattle Seahawks what they needed defensively because they didn't have a pass rusher when they weren't able to secure Jadeveon Clowney, who hasn't played well for the Tennessee Titans. He hasn't given them any of that.
He's done now. Yeah, zero sacks. Done.
You know, like, I mean, they get Jamal Adams, and Jamal Adams has come in, has given them 7.5 sacks. He's been their best pass rusher. And even though he has some deficiencies and limitations in coverage, for what they're asking him to do as a box area defender, he's been perfect. I even think about, like, Leonard Williams and what Leonard Williams has done in the 2 years
for
the
Giants.
He's been great for them. And so recently we've seen that the teams that have – gone for the proven commodity as opposed to waiting to see what's behind door number one or door number two, they've been successful. And I do wonder, as we think about this draft and going forward, will more general managers think about, hey, give me what I've seen have success at this level, as opposed to what could be what I could acquire on the draft?
Yeah, it's interesting when we look at the other side of it, right? So for, you know, Minnesota, I really think that is a win-win, mm-hmm. you know, for both teams. They get exactly what they wanted. When you look at the numbers here, Stephon Diggs has caught 90 balls, right? That's a big total. He's caught 90 balls to Justin Jefferson, 61. So you've had a lot more opportunities to make, you know, plays underneath, and Stephon Diggs done a really nice job of that. Justin Jefferson has two more receiving yards, 1,039 to 1,037. He's got three more touchdowns, 7 to 4, and average per catch, obviously much bigger, 17 to 11.5. So Justin Jefferson's having a historical year. He's on pace. I saw this thing. He's on pace to have the most receiving yards in the modern era, like going to surpass Randy Moss from his rookie mm-hmm. year and Anquan Boldin. I think those are the top two, like over 1,300 yards if he holds pace here. So he's been awesome and outstanding. But I understand it from the Buffalo side, which was still, as much as we love Justin Jefferson, there's always a little unknown when you're drafting somebody. Stephon Diggs is a known commodity. Mm-hmm. You know exactly what you're getting. And he's been exactly who they thought he was going to be. And he's been a nice outlet and a nice security blanket there for Josh Allen. And you can't argue with the results, not only from what he's done, but from Josh Allen and his comfort level and where he's taken his game to a whole new level. So I think that's a great example of it working out for both teams. The Jamal Adams thing, we've talked about this before. The Jets they don't have a win. They aren't on the cusp. They have a little bit of a rebuilding process ahead of them. So being able to secure more picks and more assets, and as well as cap space, being able to use some of that money to sprinkle around, they can spend that money on some other positions, the key positions where they don't have any good players. So that one, I think, has got another chance to work out for both teams. The one that I can't make any sense out of is DeAndre Hopkins. If you're going to trade him, like, it's kind of like the Diggs thing, right? Well, man, that's a really good player. If you're going to trade him, you better be sure you're getting some equal value back. And I can't look at that Hopkins trade and say, I understand what you're saying in terms of paying Deshaun Watson and some of the money stuff, and it just doesn't really fit. We want to sprinkle those resources around. I get a little bit of that, but you still got to get fair value if you're going to trade him. They didn't get anywhere near fair value.
No, and I just think that's just – being unable to recognize what you have and not understanding the market value for the player that you have and what you can get. And he got fleeced. And the Texans they haven't been able to make that up. And, you know, when you come to Deshaun Watson, Deshaun Watson has been able to play great in spite of that. But yeah, like, that's a huge loss. I might contend that it actually has enabled Deshaun Watson to play better, because you kind of took the training wheels off and you made him play like full quarterback and utilize all of the weapons or the people that he had around him. But yeah, I mean, I don't know how you can say that. And I think for the Cardinals, I mean, it's been good. He's the number one because Larry Fitzgerald was older. Christian Kirk was not necessarily built to be a number one receiver. So it fit a nice need. They were able to re-sign him and get him and do all this stuff. So he'll be their number one receiver going forward. But on the other end, I just don't know. I think a lot of it is, when you're a decision maker, is being able to understand what's on the horizon in the draft class. What is available? Yeah. What's available versus where we need? If there's a huge surplus, or there enough where we feel like we can fit the bill and we're like, okay, let's trade off an asset, whatever. Years ago, back in the day, Ron Wolf would always talk about the premise behind taking the best available player. Is that if you take the best available player, even at a position where you're pretty loaded at, it gives you a surplus. And if you have a surplus, then you can auction it off to get eventually what you need. And so there is something to be said for that. There's something to be said for acquiring enough talent that you can trade off some of these guys and get assets in return to help you fill out your team. But you just have to be really, really good at picking players and assessing market value, and also assessing what the next draft classes will also bring in return.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting a year to have this many trades like that. And we'll see what happens as we go into this next offseason, how it shapes up. But I think those two topics we just hit there, the uncertainty, trying to figure out this draft class with the opt-outs and some guys playing more games than others, and, you know, just the whole thing, you know, maybe the elimination of some of these all-star games, it's going to make it more difficult. So that makes sense why you would be more willing to part with some of those picks, but also opportunity, because if you look at it from that standpoint, if you're the team that gets buttoned up and handles and gets your information and really, you know, has a good feel for this draft, I think you're going to see this draft more than any other, where you're going to be picking in the third round and it's going to be, you know, whatever, pick 72. Mm-hmm. And you're going to be like, dude, our 20th player is available. You know what I mean? Because they're going to be stacked so differently across the league.
Yeah, I think that is really, really important. It's going to be something to watch as we go forward. Every draft board is always different. But this year, the variances between draft boards
will be crazy. It's going to be significant. I'm already convinced. Look, every year, my goal is always to try and have something on every player that gets picked, you know, and inevitably it's five to eight guys that get picked that you don't have. You watch, I think I end up normally with like 400 guys. So 400 guys, there's 250 picks or whatever there are. And still there's going to be five to eight guys that get picked that just, you don't know who they are.
And I haven't guessed
this year, dude, Buck. There's going to be like 40, 50 guys that get picked that I'm not going to have anything on because it's flying blind.
And it's a very, very challenging process as it is, and trying to compile. Just so like a little behind baseball, most teams that I've been around or familiar with, like the draft board typically has anywhere from 100 to 150 names.
Yeah, we were at 150 everywhere I've worked, 150.
Some other teams have 200 or so, but normally you just know those. But to think about all the variances this year, they're going to be guys that get drafted that ownership and people are going to ask you about. You're like, we don't know. I mean, what do you want to do? So,
all right, I think we've got Coach here. Let's bring in Coach Billick. He's going to join us. All right, Coach, first of all, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm just curious, what does Brian Billick have going on during the day today? What'd you do before you joined us today?
Today's my podcast day, and so I'm kind of jumping around through here. I've got to tell you, I told Bucky before, we just finished. I was coaching my grandson's third grade football team.
Oh, you're coaching? Nice. You're coaching
the defensive coordinator, and it's a little bit different. It's, okay, do you have your helmet? Are your shoes tied? Right. Are you supposed to be in now or should you be on the side? I mean, I told someone, they said, well, how is it comparing to coaching pro players? I said, well, one group is young, immature, and irresponsible. And the third graders aren't easy to work with either. So.
Coach, I think I'm a firm believer that it's not much different. I think
coaching is coaching. It is.
Yeah, I think teaching and coaching is great. And thinking about that, Coach, we're at the time of year where inevitably there are going to be some coaching changes. And on the outside, there are a lot of conversation about which guys are the most qualified. This guy would be a great head coach and those things. Having sat in that chair and been responsible for building a team, a Super Bowl winner, what are the essential qualities and characteristics that we should be looking for from a head coaching candidate?
You know, it's funny because during the hiring process, you become focused on the flavor of the month, usually an offensive or defensive coordinator. We have expanded a little bit with Joe Judge and the special teams coaches, which I think is great. I think that's an untapped resource. Because you have someone that, one, works with the entire team, two, really has to work with players who really don't want to be doing that. You know, no one goes in the backyard as a kid and pretends that they're covering kickoffs, right? They're catching touchdowns and throwing the ball and whatever. And they have to look at athletes in a framework of, okay, maybe he's not a starter. Maybe he's not a 65-snap guy, but he's a 15-snap guy. Or a 20-snap guy that can give me quality special team snap. So that's a good perspective to have. And I think the mistakes that are made is when the powers that be look at round up the usual suspect, they become too focused on, okay, this is an offensive guy, this is a defensive guy, rather than the little bit harder of stepping back and deciding, okay, first off, what are the qualities that we're looking for in a head coach? You know, typically it's okay, they're just going to round up the usual suspects and okay, well, I like what this guy said, rather than go, well, wait a minute. And I think Baltimore has done a good job with that over the years. I think Ozzie Newsome and could enlighten you in terms of the process they went through, whether it was my hiring or John Harbaugh's, where it was, well, okay, wait a minute. let's identify what it is we're specifically looking for. What qualities? And it's different from one team to another, you know, because it's where are you at and what do you need at that time? What kind of transition are you making? And okay, now let's see if we can identify guys that have those attributes rather than, okay, let's just bring in a bunch of guys that are on the top of the list. And we kind of like what this guy said the most, so we're going to hire him.
Coach, I'm glad you talked about qualities there, because I wrote down the ones that I would want in a head coach. And I want to get your feedback on that and see maybe there's some holes in what we're missing here. I talked about start with leadership, and that envelops being an excellent communicator, cast the vision, create the culture, and be able to cultivate relationships individually, you know, downstairs, upstairs, across the whole building. A teacher, which I think is underutilized, just prioritizing the details, and that's in your preparation and then also in your development. With everybody individually. And then the last one I think is the most important, which is authentic. You're honest, reliable, dependable. You kind of know who you are. You're comfortable in your own skin.
Yeah.
In terms of the mistakes that are made, I mean, you've seen it. You've been around forever, Coach. Like those, Mike Tomlin's very comfortable in who he is. Andy Reid and Mike Tomlin, I mean, polar opposite personalities, but they're very authentic. You know exactly who they are. Trying to hire somebody that's the junior version of somebody else, and Bill Belichick could be a great example. Like don't try and be Bill, just be you.
It's the classic. That's why the litany of Bill Belichick disciples, Joe Gibbs was the same way. Those guys, for whatever reason, did not do well because they tried to be mini Joe Gibbs. They tried to be mini Bill Belichick's, which you're exactly right. If you're trying to be somebody else, you cannot sustain it. It all sounds good up front. I've often said, hence leaving coaching, particularly in my corporate speaking, when people have always said, well, why don't you go back into coaching? And my answer has always been, well, they want young and cheap, and I'm neither, so I'm done with it. But I said, I learned a lot. I've got to tell you, I learned a lot when I left and was doing game for Fox, because what did I do? Every Friday, I'm sitting in another building, talking to players, coaches, general managers, owners. I'm watching, in many instances, invited into meetings and watching how they practice and how they do this. Have sat in virtually every, you know, imagine getting to sit in your competitor's boardroom. Yeah. So I said, if I did come back to coaching and I would be better at it because of that experience, here's exactly what I'd do. One, and you begin with a certain fundamental knowledge of the game. Those that are interviewing from the football standpoint, quite frankly, and I always tell guys that I mentor in terms of interviewing, I always tell them, remember, you're the expert, because quite frankly, the guys that are asking you the question don't even know the right question to ask. Okay. In most instances, they've never really done it. So when it comes to the football part of it, you're the expert. But now with regards to the other thing, I would first bring together, obviously, the best staff I could. And we were pretty good at that in terms of the best quality of people, the diversity that you want. You don't want all the same guy. You know, players have to be able to go and sound off at different people. Everybody brings something a little different to the table. So you put the best staff can together. You create a unified vision for where you're going. And it's amazing how often that doesn't happen. Offense, defense, special teams, the organizational whole, where is it we think we are? Where are we going? What kind of athletes do we need to get there? And do we have the same, you can scrunch it around, we can disagree, but at the end of the day, do we have this shared vision in terms of what we're looking for? Play like a Raven was the term, right, DJ, that we talked about? And then as the head coach, my job would be to spend every waking minute, player by player, every person in the organization, pushing them towards the leadership of the coaches. Mm-hmm. To make sure that they were following that vision that we had set. And you're right, DJ. It is a day-to-day. It's not a one lecture, one size fit all. I mean, it's a day-to-day touching every player, to a lesser degree, but still everybody in the organization as well, to make sure that we're all, you know, reading from the same hymnal.
Real quick, Buck, I want to just finish that point there, Coach. We had Dave Roberts on, just won the World Series with the Dodgers, and he talked about that we talk about all the time, but he said he would try and really schedule time every day with different players individually to have that one-on-one, where they are, where they need to go, what they need to do to get there. And we've kind of said, if you're going to get somebody that's got the best scheme in the world, that's going to hide in his corner office and draw plays up all day long, like, you got the wrong guy.
Right. That, and it doesn't exist. That guy does not exist. And so that interaction, and as you know, DJ, that's one of the reasons I ran the scout teams. Mm-hmm. The reason I did that is it forced me to touch everybody on the team. On, you know, the starters you'd normally have an interaction, but that next level guy, because I was running the scout team, the prep team on both sides, and Denny Green taught me that. And it was a way for me to touch the players and interact with these guys every day.
Coach, that's great. You talked about running the scout teams. I will say this. During my time in Green Bay, Andy Reid was the tight end coach, and he ran the scout team and scout team defense and on the cars and those things. Gained a lot of respect for him and his ability to relate and those things. I think one of the things that may be underrated when it comes to being a head coach is adaptability and being able to change. You obviously came from Minnesota where you guys played a certain way offensively, and Baltimore, at some point you had to change a little bit based on the strengths of the team. How stubborn should the head coach be when it comes to how he's used to playing versus, hey, this team is built a certain way. I have to coach and get them to play a different way because that's the best way for them to win.
Oh, absolutely. When I talked about creating that shared vision and the athletes that we need to execute that vision, that's all well and very good. But at the end of the day, when you get an athlete, it's okay. You better adapt it to what does he do best. I remember when Bill Walsh, who was obviously a mentor of mine and consulted on a regular basis, and I was in Minnesota, and Denny Green, you know, Denny was the biggest mentor I had, but he had come from Bill Walsh. So, you know, there was residual effect there in terms of my mentor being mentored by these two great coaches. And I remember when I had Randall Cunningham in Minnesota, and I would talk with Bill and go, okay, so what should I be doing? He says, you need another quarterback. And he says, you need, you know, because for what you need to do to so-and-so, you need, I said, oh, okay. But that's who I've got, Bill. So what do I, and he was, no, you need another quarterback. You know, he wouldn't, you know, and not that Bill wouldn't be flexible, but Bill, obviously his quarterbacks, he had a very specific skill set that he wanted from his quarterback position, which is all well and good. And he found it in a number of different ways, but you're absolutely right. You better adapt. And for me, it was when I got to Baltimore, I'm this supposed offensive guru, which is all BS as we know, but I came in as an offensive guy. And so you think this is what it takes to win a championship. We got to have a certain level. And I just come from the highest scoring offense in the history of the league in Minnesota. Well, I get there and there's this record setting defense, not only record setting defense, maybe the best single season defense in the history of the game. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until about midway through that first year that it dawned on me, okay, no, if we run the ball and don't turn the ball over, we can win a championship. And that was a major shift to be able to say, yes, we can win a championship that way. And this defense is good enough to do that with. So I had to change my mindset in play calling and what we were doing to understand, no, we can play to that strength and win a championship. Because otherwise you can do the other thing and work up a lot of numbers. But if you come short of, you know, if you don't win the Super Bowl, then it's all for naught in today's NFL. So that, you're right. For a lot of guys, that is a major sea change to say, okay, this is what I've always believed we needed to win, but I've got a group of athletes that are unique and we can probably, you know, Tony Dungy, I think, will tell you that on the flip side. You know, the football gods are funny guys now. I mean, here they give me an offensive guy, the greatest single defense in it, and they give Tony Dungy, you know, maybe one of the best quarterback. And Tony had to change your mind because he'd been a defensive guy and thought of, okay, this is what we do to develop a championship, and certainly instrumented in Tampa, but then got to Indianapolis, and Tony adapted to say, oh, well, okay, maybe we do need to change in terms of our mindset because we have a pretty special guy and a pretty special offense here.
Coach, I want to talk about dividing powers here. Obviously, the success with Baltimore, and Baltimore has been a personnel-driven team when it comes to the offseason, a coach-driven team when it comes to the season. Split powers there between the two. Mm-hmm. We see a lot of coaches in, you know, they have some success, and then they really want to get all the power to be able to be in charge of the whole thing. We've seen Belichick do it well. We've seen Andy Reid do it well. We've seen a lot of other guys fail. I'm just curious with you, was there ever a point in your career where you thought, man, I would like to go somewhere and have all that power? Or did you, you know, what were your thoughts on dividing that, no, that responsibility?
Because that no one's that smart. I remember I did a lecture at a banking group, and they were, the whole idea was they came together and they were, it was a succession plan. Where do we go to replace ourselves and build this succession plan for the bank? And the owner of the bank, or the head of the bank, was a guy, he must have been 80 years old, very sharp, very clear. He's listened to all that. And he's listening, oh, this, no, it needs to come out of the equities department. No, it comes out of commercial real estate. Everybody had their little silos and what they thought the next president needed to be. And he got up and says, guys, wait a minute, hold on. 40 years ago, when I took over this bank, I was the smartest guy in the room, okay? Mm-hmm. That doesn't exist now. We don't need the guy with all the right answers. That doesn't exist. We need the guy with the right questions. And so you see it all the time. It always amuses me. And it's usually offensive guys. You're an offensive guru. Okay, you're play caller, which is a 24-7, right? I mean, you are obsessed with it. You are immersed. Every waking moment, you are focused on design and play calling and the whole thing. And it can wear you out. Then you get a head job and you go, well, I can do that and be the head coach. I can do all those, you know, I can now, where before it was, you know, I was sleeping 5 hours a night and totally, but okay, now I can, and, but you learn. No, you can't. You better learn to delegate. I always used to call it the 3 a.m. rule. At 3 a.m., if you wait, and I'm at an age where I wake up at 3 a.m. and go to the bathroom and lay, you know, every night. What are you thinking about? If you're thinking about, do I put the full back in the flat? Do I run the angle here? Well, then that's great. Then you're the coordinator. Who's waking up at 3 a.m. going, where's my next backup center coming from? Who should we be looking here? What about the cap? Who, you better have someone that you can rely on. Now you can create, it can all clear through you if that's what you want to do. You know, you said it right. I mean, Ozzie Newsom, it was the perfect partner because he listened, for one. And as you know, we used to call it scrimmaging, right? We'd come in and scrimmage. Shaq Harris would come in and would scrimmage. And I can't tell you how many times Ozzie and I, and Ozzie always, I knew, I always appreciated the fact that Ozzie understood and appreciated the pressures I was under. And I tried to do the same with him. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell how many times we'd be scrimmaging on a subject and I'd be on one side and he'll be on the other. And he'll go, well, let's sleep on it and let's reconvene in the morning. We'll come back in the morning. I go, Ozzie, I was thinking, I slept on it. Yeah, I think you're probably right. We need to. And coach, I was doing the same thing. I think you're right. Mm-hmm. You know, and that ability to have that give and take and not rely on just whose great idea it was, but to take ownership of it, that kind of, and you know, you can only do that so far, but that kind of give and take, the game is too complex. There's too much going on for it to be legitimately one style. Okay, Belichick, and I get it, and that's probably, but that's the only one that I can think of. You look at the other great organizations, there's usually a trifecta, a triumvirate, or at least the bet, you know, the general manager and head coach together. It's a working relationship. I don't think there's another organization where you can look at it like in New England and just go, okay, this is totally it.
Can it work with more than two? Because baseball, when I study baseball right now, coach, they have a leadership teams of like four or five guys, and that you can throw the manager as part of that, but really it's kind of a collection. And it started with the Tampa Bay Rays with their general manager who went to the Dodgers, and as Andrew Friedman has since built them into a powerhouse and a juggernaut. But he just kind of what you said was like, why should we assume that one or two of us have all the answers? We're going to find, if we can find four or five guys that are very bright in their own way and we put our heads together, we can come up with the right decision. And it's worked in baseball. Could that work in football?
Four and five is too many. I mean, you'd love to have that kind of quality. The problem you have is when you have three is perfect. Two is fine, but three. The reason I say three now, you and each of them can have lieutenants that are, you know, top of the charts as well. But the thing I like about three, I keep coming back to, if you have the three right guys, you drive great comfort going, two of the three of us are going to be right.
Yeah.
Right. There's always that. If all three say something's good, we're good to go.
Yeah.
But if two of the three like it, you're probably, you know, now if all three don't like it, okay, well then you got to reconvene. But if two of the three, to me, that's a great counterbalance.
I like that.
And going for it. Yeah.
Coach, I want to lean into this because your experience, I think you'd be uniquely qualified. And this is an extension of that question. In thinking about being the head coach, and if you could pick your personnel people, like you talked about shared visions and those things, how important is it for you guys to see football the same way in terms of what is essential to building a championship team? Or can you have a general manager that may come from maybe a different system, a different viewpoint, but you guys find a way to make it work?
I think that goes back to the shared vision in visiting, in listening and visiting with different coaches. I think Gary Kubiak was probably as good at this as anybody I've been around in terms of communicating. And it's not just, okay, this is what I want. No, I mean, it's a conversation. It's a scrimmage in terms of, all right, here's the attributes player by player of what I need. Okay, I need a running back that can do X, Y, and catch the ball as opposed to run different combinations. I always say, we've talked about it before, DJ. I want a receiving core. I want a basketball team. I don't want all power forwards. I want a power forward. I want a big man. I want a point guard. I want an off guard. And each has different attributes. And here's what the attributes I need from this athlete. And that needs to be fine. That's heavy lifting now. You got to spend a lot of time between the coaches and the scouts understanding this is what we're looking for. Your offensive line coach needs to be very specific. This is what I'm looking for in a center versus a guard versus a tackle. Now, you can negotiate it. You can scrimmage it around a little bit to try to better understand it. But at the end of the day, this is what we see we need for this offense or defense to work. Then it's the jobs of the scouts to go, okay, I've got to go find guys in that position that fits that criteria. Now, typically that means coming back and negotiating a little bit because no one's going to fit it perfectly. God, coach, Bucky, I love this guard. Now, I know you wanted a little more punch from this guy, but I think he makes so – yeah, you never get unless you know, yeah, he's the first overall pick and he's seven across the boards and, oh, yeah, he's got it all. Well, that's simple. But the negotiation about because you're negotiating a little bit with because nobody has it all. So what am I willing to overlook? Does this offset that to make me, okay, yes, because otherwise you become so strident in your view of a player, nobody fits. And then you just caught coaches going, well, you're not bringing me the right players. Well, I'm bringing you what's available. Okay, well, you got to take somebody. Let's negotiate. Let's get as close to it as we can. But we do all have to have the same shared idea of what we're looking for in those particular talents.
All right, Coach, you've been so generous with your time today. We had a million different things we were going to go into, but this was just great.
I talked too much. That's a nice
We kept staying on it because we're keeping pages full of notes here on everything we're doing. Last thing before we let you go, I remember – I had to be the Turk 1 year in Baltimore and would bring guys to you and you'd have to tell them that was it. I remember standing outside the office in training camp at the Best Western, right? Wasn't that the name of the hotel up there in Westminster?
Right.
And Mike Solwald was the long snapper and you told him that you were going to let him go. And he had said, I could hear him. And he said, this is BS. This is not fair. And then you didn't know what to say on that one. And he said, you didn't even give me a chance to play quarterback. And then I heard the loudest laughter I'd ever heard from you in 4 years during that time. But is there any other story, Coach, that I might not be privy to when you had to have those conversations?
The best one. I used to get on you guys because remember now, training camp, it's all, you know, it's a blur of faces. And when you're cutting a lot of guys, you know, he's not wearing his jersey. I know who 46 is, but I don't know. So – they brought me, it was Jones, I think was the tight end. They bring me a tight end and he sits down in front of me and I start going into the routine and I'm looking at him and I'm going, cause you get to reading body language when you do this enough. Yep. It's a tough thing to do. I've been cut. I always try to remember Tom Landry spent 20 minutes with me when I got cut.
Wow.
Now, he had better things to do than spend 20 minutes with me. And I thought, you know what, if I ever get in that position, I need to remember the way Coach Landry handled it. Cause you're ending a dream. It's like the Clint Eastwood line in Unforgiven. You're not only ending what a man has, you're ending what a man ever is going to have, you know, in terms of that dream to to be a pro player.
That was John Jones, by the way, coach.
Yes, John Jones. Very good. So he and I'm going through it, and he's got a quizzical. I'm thinking, this guy should know better. This guy should know he's on the ball. He is truly shocked. And then it dawns on me, they brought me the wrong guy. we're keeping this guy. Well, now I look like the village idiot because I've done my whole, oh, Jesus, not my place to say you can't, but it's just, it's my job to say it's not here. And he's truly, so now I got to, how do I salvage this? So I look at him and said, all right, John, that's what it feels like to be cut. You've made this football team, but I don't ever want to have this conversation with you. So get your you and your playbook back in there and keep working. You know, so I pulled it out brilliantly. You know,
well, I can say I don't think that one was mine, coach. But I went into the offensive line room and I had grabbed who I thought was a player, and I had grabbed Damian Cook, if you remember him, by accident.
Yes.
I didn't know what he looked like, right? So I grabbed him. So we start walking up the stairs to go upstairs in the old facility. And then I start talking to him, and I realize this is not who I think it is. So I got to take him back into the offensive line room and then say the name of the guy I have to get. And J.O., Jonathan Ogden, goes, dang, they're cutting everybody. And,
this guy left. That guy left. Wow.
No, it was not a good thing, man.
You could do a series on this. It would be a great comedy sketch because it really is. It's amazing some of the conversations you have and some of the mistakes you make.
Last thing I want to say about Coach before we let him go, just to remind everybody how great Coach Billick is. Not only is a coach and what he does on television, how good of a person he is. As we get to Christmas, Buck, I'm always remember back to a time when I was a poor scout, had no money at all, and Coach came and gave all of us a check out of his own wallet for $1,000. And as scouts at that time, that was might as well have been $1 million at that time. We went and bought a Mac computer. And I just remember we had that computer forever. We always called that computer the Brian Billick computer because we were very thankful for Coach. Coach, you've always been generous in every way. You've been generous to me over the years, and I appreciate it.
I'm gonna interject because it reminded me of when you guys were talking about the 150 board. You always had, you know, your 150 players on your board. And you're always shocked at how quickly that thing empties. And we always had, remember, we used to have the sideboard. And I told the scouts, okay, it was like $2,000 or $3,000. If you pick the first guy to come off the sideboard.
Yep.
Which that energized some things. Now, and guys all have their guys in back pocket. And that got kind of fun. That was always fun to see which guy was coming off that sideboard first.
You did first guy off the sideboard. You did one for lowest person on the front board that got picked the highest. So in other words, so somebody would be on the bottom of our front board might go in the first round. So we would do that. And so literally the draft's going on. And man, it's moving and shaking like we're doing a 50-50 raffle.
And so it's funny that you guys are talking about that because I would sit up with Shaq and Art Perkins and Ozzie at the combine. And we would bet on combine performance 40 times.
Oh, yeah.
Over vertical unders. Jumps or whatever. Yeah, so I feel like even though I never worked with the Ravens, I am so impacted and influenced by the Ravens because all of those guys were like my mentor. So it's funny to hear you guys
Shaq
talk about
this
because I felt like it never ended. Everything was a competition. Everything was something about that as related to scouting.
You'll remember this. So these moments where you'd be timing 40s and you'd be in the meeting and you'd be debating a player, right? I like Jones. He likes Smith. And I'd be like, well, Smith can't run. Smith's going to run 4.65. Like, no, Smith's going to run in the low 4.5. So literally, and at the combine, if you've seen it on television, you know, like there's no talking. You could hear a pin drop. But what you'll see, if you pay attention and you look at some of the teams, you'll see the clock go like this and you'll see somebody go. And you know who got the best of that from the draft meetings. Those are fun memories.
Well, when they started televising the draft, it got that made things dicey now because now I remember we were I was still coaching and I was sitting, I was visiting with Mike Nolan up in the stands. And you know, it's also kind of a job fair there's a lot going on. So I'm and all of a sudden I get a buzz on my phone and it's my daughter. I go, "What's up, honey?" He goes, "Aren't you at the combine looking at?" I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Then why are you screwing around talking to Mike Nolan? Why aren't you watching?" Oh boy, I got busted by my daughter. She's going, "Quit screwing around, John, with Mike Nolan. Get your eyes back on the field and find us a tight end." You know,
that's great. She knows. She knows.
She knew. Hey, she knew.
Coach, this is so much fun today. Thank you so much for your time.
Do it again.
Appreciate you. Well, Buck, it's great to catch up with Coach Billick. He's the best, man. And I do encourage everybody to check out the new podcast. I think the trailer might already be up. You can check it out. It's a Total Access podcast with Brian Billick, who you just heard, along with our good buddy Michael Robinson, who's a Super Bowl winning fullback with the Seattle Seahawks and one of the best we have at NFL Media Group. It's a great guy. I'm looking forward to checking that out.
Yeah, no, Austin, he's terrific, man. He's so terrific in so many different areas. He is someone that I've leaned on just for regular advice when it comes to like coaching high school ball. But I think this conversation that we just had as it relates to being a head coach, but really working hand in hand with a general manager, I think that's stuff that you don't often have open discussions about, but I think is very, very necessary. And I will say this, DJ, like obviously, because I know you've done a lot of homework on the team building stuff, and we look at like team building from a shared vision, but maybe coming from different angles. The leadership council conversation to me is fascinating. I think
that's isn't that interesting?
I think that's one that we're going to have to revisit in time, because for you to do some research on baseball and to kind of go behind the scenes on that, I always look at basketball and how they build teams and talking to guys in that aspect. But then for Coach Billick to bring out the three,
I like the three.
I think three is actually the perfect number, because it reminds me of the government and having like a checks and balances system.
Three branches.
And then when you get to it, if you have to have the straw vote, hey man, somebody has to.
Yep. So it's a winner and a loser with the decision.
Yeah.
Because I think it's great.
Yeah. When you talk about four, like you have even numbers, but when you have the odd number, I think it makes it interesting. I don't know how that's developed. I don't know if that's head coach, general manager, and X, but it is definitely something worth exploring and expanding out.
Yeah, I that's something we can dig into. Absolutely. All right. Well, that's going to do it for us today. It was a fun episode. Great to have Coach Billick again. Thanks to him for giving us all that time today. Hope you guys have enjoyed it. Remember, you can leave us some comments and reviews there on Apple Podcasts. We do appreciate those. If you got them, want to wish everybody a happy holiday season as we are right in the thick of the month of December. The football is good, and the conversation here is good as well. That's going to do it for us. We'll catch you next time right here on Move the Sticks, presented by Zaxby's.